Louise, welcome to Bendix and Airways.
Thank you very much for having me.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself and what you do?
My name is Luisa Weigand. I'm originally from Munich, in Germany, and I've been studying molecular biotechnology, which has now led me to work in cancer immunotherapy in the UK and then now in Norway.
What kind of education do you need to do what you do?
It could be different types of studies. So you could either go down the route of studying medicine and then go rather into research rather than working as a medic in a clinic or in a practice. Alternatively, different types of chemistry, biochemistry, biology can lead you into that path that I went down.
Why do so many people get cancer?
Well, that's a loaded question. Really, it's because we are managing to get older and older, and cancer typically is an accumulation of mutations in our DNA, in our genome. And the older we get, the more mutations we will accumulate. And it's certainly also due to the fact that we don't necessarily have the most healthy lifestyle, which certainly contributes to this. But I think overall, really, it's the fact that we get older and older, so we get more exposed to this kind of disease.
What about the environment and toxins and stuff?
Yeah, they do play a role. It's, of course, everyone knows I shouldn't smoke, I maybe shouldn't drink too much, I should not expose myself to a lot of car fuels, fumes. And at the same time, just because you're trying not to expose yourself and to eat healthy, it doesn't automatically mean that you don't have a cancer risk, because of course there's also part of cancer risk which is inherited. And in that context, you can still absolutely develop cancer.
My grandmother had cancer. How much of a risk am I at? Or is that impossible to say?
It depends. It's relatively impossible to say. I would say there are certain cancer types that can be predictive. So I think most people are aware of the BRCA mutations, which are breast cancer mutations that are inherited, and that can be people can be tested for when their mother dies of breast cancer very young. Women are very prone to that kind of disease also. But this is not true for all types of cancer. So depending on what kind of cancer she had, you may or may not have an increased risk of cancer.
I see. So how did you, what's your journey and how did you become involved in this, the things you do now?
Yeah, so I guess already during my studies, I was really fascinated by virology, immunology, and oncology. These were always my favorite topics to get my teeth into and understand better and better. And as it happens, in my master thesis, I started working on cancer immunotherapy. And I was so fascinated by it. And I was very lucky to get a position for the PhD thesis in that very group. And I stayed on to do my PhD in that topic. And from then, I was kind of, taken with it
Sold.
and, sold. And of course, I was very lucky because I joined this area of research in at a time where it was a very small area of research. When you went to a conference to do with cancer immunotherapy, like around between, I would say, 2008, 2009, 2010, you would see that there is only very few people at these conferences, very tiny, and it was a tiny session at the massive conferences. It was not very well known, and now it's a really major part of cancer immunotherapy. So it's been really lucky and brilliant to be part of this evolution of the success of cancer immunotherapy.
What is it? What is cancer immunotherapy?
So cancer immunotherapy really covers a lot of different types of therapies that are all involving our own immune system to try to cure cancer.
Okay.
So what that can be is either giving some small molecules or some antibodies, for example, that will engage our immune cells, for example, T cells, very famously, that are typically in our bodies to protect us, for example, from viral infections. And that we will be able to redirect to kill cancer cells. Another way of doing this is really very related to what I do now also in at Zelluna, is using cell therapy. So originally, the original concept is to use T cells from a patient, genetically engineer them. So you infect them with a virus mm-hmm. that will contain a gene that will help the T cell to express a receptor that's able to recognize the cancer cell and tell the T cell to kill that cell when it binds.
Is that kind of like vaccines work?
Well, vaccines work slightly differently in that a vaccine, whatever type of vaccine you take, it typically is you give a certain structure to the immune system, and the immune system, the cells in the body of the patient will get triggered, and then they will expand. And that's how these cells then are potentially able to recognize, well, either a virus or cancer. So it's more activating the immune system that we have, whereas cell therapy, you put something into your cell to tell the cell, now you will be killing the cancer cell, if you want to say so, when you give these cells back to the patient.
So is this treatment instead of other treatments, or is it in addition to, and is it used on all cancers?
So currently it's in addition to mostly, and it depends on what type of immunotherapy, which cancers. So for instance, you have still a very huge, massive place, and really the most known part of cancer therapy still is chemotherapy and radiotherapy and different antibody therapies, for example. But immunotherapy is very often complementary, and also for now is very often the last resort that patients have. Okay. And that has to do with how we develop cancer therapies, because typically the patient who gets diagnosed with cancer will have a certain course of treatments that will be tried to hopefully put the patient into remission, the cancer into remission, or that will help even to cure certain cancers can be cured. However, when nothing helps them, this is when actually these novel therapies that are not approved yet will be used. So for instance, if we with our therapy now will treat the first patients, these patients will be patients that have no other option. Okay. They will have received any treatment that is proven to hopefully give them some improvement, and only then will they receive immunotherapy. But some immunotherapies have already been tested so well that they have now moved up, as we say, the treatment line. So when they were last line treatment, now they might be second, third line treatments already for patients.
And I'm not finding the right word, but not feedback, but what kind of results have you seen in your tests using this method?
Well, you mean in the clinical studies that we did? So, you know, I mean, in the companies I worked in, one very exciting one, I think, is really when I used to work at Immunocore. This is not a cell therapy per se, but it's immune cell engager, as we call them. So what this is, it's a molecule that recognizes, you can imagine it a bit like an antibody. It recognizes the T cell and activates the T cell, so the immune cell in the patient. And the other end of this antibody fragment is a so-called T cell receptor. And a T cell receptor, I will need to explain a bit more what that molecule is, but ultimately it enables us to recognize a cancer cell also. And so when the molecule binds both the cancer cell and a T cell, it will engage the T cell to kill the cancer cell. And so the very exciting product that was approved in the last couple of years was for uveal melanoma. It's IMC-GP100. And the reason I'm mentioning this is because one of the challenges is actually treating populations that have very rare cancers, because of course everyone is striving to treat a lot of patients and to help a lot of patients, but also there we mustn't forget that there is a lot of cancers that are very rare cancers, and these often don't get any new treatment options for decades. And so it's very exciting that this one actually had such a huge impact on their outcomes.
What are the cancers that are most easily treated, if you can say it like that?
That's a challenging question. I think there is cancers, there is different subgroups of cancers that can be treated more easily. So I think everyone probably knows someone or of someone who has been suffering, for example, from breast cancer. And there, it very much depends what type of breast cancer the person has, because some breast cancer types also, of course, earlier they're recognized, they can be treated very well, and patients can really be in remission for a very, very long time and live very well after a cancer diagnosis. And this is also probably true for certain types of subtypes also of maybe colon cancer, for example. But where it gets very tricky is really, for example, pancreatic cancer.
Okay.
Pancreatic cancer is very aggressive, and the challenge there is mainly also that it gets recognized very, very late, because the symptoms for the patient are recognized very late in the day.
And that brings me to screening. If you say that it gets recognized very late, how can you screen for this? And is it effective to screen for this?
So there is, it very much depends on the organ you're looking at and the symptoms you're looking at. I think some cancers are very hard to detect, like pancreatic cancer, as I just mentioned. Others are quite easy to detect and are also being more routinely checked for. For instance, typically prostate cancer should be checked for quite regularly, breast cancer. And these are quite easily detectable. And I wouldn't necessarily say that it's the detection method that's tricky for some cancers, maybe for very niche cancers, but not for the most part of it. It's really more how, when do you discover them and why do you have a symptom and that's why you discover them. But the method to actually detect the cancers, they are really very, very well established.
Hmm. I've read several places and several times that it's the screening for breast cancer can be very difficult, and it doesn't always give you what you need to tell if it's breast cancer or if it's not.
Yes, so the challenge with breast cancer is that you may have breast tissue that has more, now I don't find the English word, but you know, there is, if you want to say so, breasts that have more, they're more nodular in a way. And so then it's really hard to say for sure what it is. And that's when you biopsy. But again, once you biopsy the nodule, then you will actually very easily be able to tell whether it's cancer or not.
Yeah.
But you're right. So, you know, you may need a biopsy, but ultimately, again, you can detect it and you can be confident whether it is cancer or not.
I see. And what about you've been at several organizations. How has this shaped your approach to research and development in what you do now?
Yeah, so I could speak probably for hours on this. But to try to be relatively short on it. So of course, what it taught me is a lot around the science, the immune system, cancers per se. But not only this, I think in the grand scheme of things, for me and my career, I think it really taught me to focus and to persevere. because cancer research and therapy development is certainly not anything, you know, where you do work and you know you're going to have a good outcome. You tend to sometimes do something for half a year and then you find out, oh, that's a dead end, and you've worked for half a year on this and it's nothing. And it could be even worse, like could be even longer than half a year. So yeah. I think a lot of perseverance and resilience is very necessary. Focusing and being very clear about whatever it is that you're investigating and the science is telling you, whether you can translate this into a therapy feasibly. Is it feasible? There is a lot of really exciting things that we can find out about how cancer works or how the immune system works. But the challenge is then, how can we actually use this in a therapy that can be accessible to many, many patients?
Can it be emotional to work with this research?
Yes, very. I think on many levels, because of course, on the one side is, you know, when people ask you, oh, what you do for a living, and you tell them I work in cancer research, you hear a lot of very touching stories. And I've had really very touching moments also of a complete stranger to me who worked in a shop where I was buying something and who said to me, can you wait here for a minute? I really want to give you a gift. My mother had breast cancer and I really cherish that there is people like you. And I was really touched because, yeah. You know, I think the other thing about emotion in cancer immunotherapy development, or generally probably research, quite frankly, is it's just this constant striving to overcome the next challenge. And in a way, it's a different emotion, not necessarily related always to cancer, but the emotion, if you want to say so, but it's related to the fact that you've worked so hard for it. And yet you don't get anywhere.
That's my next question. Will you ever be out of a job?
Definitely not.
No. What are the most challenging things that you research and try to create treatments for? What's the most challenging now? What's like top of the list?
It's hard to say because I think every one of them has their own challenge. I think the biggest challenge generally for finding treatments is that you will only find treatments for a subgroup of patients always, because whatever indication you look at and whatever organ cancer you look at, you will have the challenge that you have a lot of subgroups of patients there. And so where do you go? What are you going to explore? And where, you know, it's so varied cancer. I think that's really important for everyone to understand. It's not there is one lung cancer, there's one breast cancer, there's one colon cancer. It's an incredibly varied disease. Cancer is not cancer. And this is why this is one of the biggest challenges, because you cannot develop that ultimate cancer drug for everyone.
No. So the cancer, all different cancers, they are very different in their makeup?
Yes. I would say
that. What are similarities, if there are?
Yeah, so the similarities are sometimes specific mutations. So as now, you know, it's very much developed regarding looking at our genome. And so there's a lot of NGS assessment also done for patients. We know that certain mutations and certain oncogenes are actually present in very different types of cancer. So you may have the same mutation in five different types of organs in different patients. And yet this mutation might be much more prevalent in one type of cancer than in others. However, you could use that mutation for, of course, these rare populations also.
Yeah.
But that would bring us to a whole different challenge, which is how do you bring it to those patients? Because you always have to show that these patients have a benefit from the treatment, even though they, you know, let's say there is a mutation that's very typical for colon cancer, and then you discover this mutation is also present in other types of cancers. You will need to show that truly these patients in that have other types of cancers will also benefit from the very same treatment. Mm. And the challenge with that is that then they might be very rare. And then how do you manage to have enough patients treated to prove to the regulators, to the governments that, you know, this is a good treatment and it gives a benefit to the patient over and above what they have as a standard of care.
Yeah. You started saying that firstly, the reason we get, or there's more cancers because we live longer and the mutations occur often at the end of life. How do you then explain people born with it?
So this is really, as I said, there is some, we all have a lot of mutations in our genome per se. And
are mutations mostly bad always?
No, not always. And this is the thing, it's part of evolution. So if this is really how also we evolve to what we are now. So mutations are actually necessary and very important for us to also develop as a species. So it's not per se something worrying or non-natural. It's very normal. But it depends on where these mutations occur, of course. And then there's, it depends on the location of the mutation, whether then also that will be inherited by the children of a person bearing that mutation. And then if they have this mutation in both alleles, so in both parts, if you want to say so, they have it from the mother and the father, for example, if it's on a not X or Y chromosome, but on a normal chromosome that's there, they will actually challenge, be having, if you want to say so, already a driver mutation that they already bear. So whatever they accumulate on top of this, if you were to say, okay, we need about 20 mutations for a cell to become cancerous, and then that's not 20 mutations per se, that's 20 mutations in genes that are either preventing us from getting cancer or that will be driver mutations, so that will actually make the cells proliferate a lot faster, and there is no system anymore in that cell then to stop this growth that's out of control. And this is where someone who has such a mutation will have the cancer much faster, because we all throughout our entire life accumulate these mutations, but they will just reach that point much faster, much younger, where they will have cancer.
See. And what kind of role does genes play in not getting it? How important is it to have, you know, sort of good genes? Some people smoke and drink their whole life and have no problems. And some do the opposite and get it when they're 30.
If only we knew that. Yeah. Maybe I'm sure there are some, you know, genetic studies on this and people are looking into this. But to my knowledge, there is nothing that's truly known about, you know, what's something that really we know for sure is protecting us from cancer.
I was listening to a podcast with Peter Attia. I don't know if you know him. He's an American, a lot of things, doctor, physician, everything. And he's been studying people living 100, 110, 120 years. And his conclusion is that it's not that they don't get these lifestyle diseases. It's just that the onset is 20, 30, 40 years later than the rest of the population. And he says that it's down to genes, and it's not that they don't get it. It's just that they get it later.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is something to be said about how, you know, the genetic makeup you bring with you and whatever accumulates on top of it. And I think that can very well drive whether or not or when someone will have cancer or not.
Yeah. What's the reason that there's almost no cancer in the heart? Do you know?
No.
No. So I've read that it's very, very rare.
Well, I could come up with an explanation though, because I presume that I would think that it might have to do with the rate of proliferation of cells in that organ. So as the mutations typically occur when the cells are dividing, And in organs where you have more dividing cells, you will accumulate more mutations because there's more opportunity to have a mistake in the copy for the next cell, if you want to say so. So it could very well be related to the fact that probably cells in the heart divide less. So,
okay.
But this is a speculation. Yeah. I haven't looked into this, quite frankly. It's a good question.
Dividing cells, is it telomeres? That what is, because I've read and heard mm-hmm. a lot about telomeres, and each time you replicate or cut off,
yes.
and that's a certain time there's nothing to copy or cut off, and then you're done.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So telomeres, they're known to be getting shorter and shorter as we grow older. And they have a protective effect on our genome. And as they get shorter, the genome gets more unstable. Now, what's very interesting, I find, is we in fact looked into, how telomeres might impact the health of cells that we are using to make them into our product, TCR NK cells. And the interesting thing is that when we spoke to the company who was doing this, they've shown us a lot of data on some leukemia patients where they looked, okay, so do the patients with the worst outcome, do they have shorter telomeres? So there is some correlation there. Yes, there is. But the very interesting thing also is that when they looked at the age of the patients, that wasn't necessarily correlating. So okay. It could be that a 30-year-old patient had much shorter telomeres than an older patient, 70, 80-year-old patient with the same disease. So this is...
Why?
Well, this is... nobody really knows, I guess, but this is very, very interesting because that means that if you were to use... Well, this is very important for us because it could be that if we were to use cells from a donor who has very short telomeres, maybe these cells are less good for our therapy, for example. It's speculative, but that could be.
Because when listening to someone speaking about it, he said that, I'm not sure how long ago it is, but that they found a big difference in lab rats or lab mice compared to wild mice. And that they just, I'm not sure how long ago it is, that there was a big difference, and that when only testing lab mice, they could end up with the wrong results because the process worked in the wild mice was very different.
So that's possible because lab mice are very different from wild mice. The reason being that if you're trying to look into a disease or if you're trying to look into a therapy, you need a very constant background, if you want to say so. So all of these mice are very genetically similar, the ones that are typically used for research, because otherwise you would have a lot of standard deviations. And, you know, if you look at 10 mice, every mouse would be very different and you wouldn't know necessarily why. And if you really want to look at the effect of one gene, you want to be sure all 10 mice are really, truly the same.
Yeah.
And so there is strains that are done for specific types of research. And this is also partly, by the way, why a lot of cancer research is also, well, cancer research is two things. So one is discovering why a cancer develops, and there is very interesting studies that can be performed in mice indeed. And then the other part to this is testing a therapy in mice, or in, for that matter, in other animals, but very typically it's the mouse. And the interesting thing is, if you have a model, a mouse model that's very well suited for whatever you're investigating, you can be pretty sure that you'll have a successful therapy. That does not automatically mean that it will be successful in the human. I think that's also very important to understand. And it's very interesting that I was very, very excited to read that the FDA has announced last year. So FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in the US, they have announced beginning of last year that, you know, they would no longer recommend or make in vivo studies, so in animal studies, necessary for certain submissions for cancer therapies. And I think that's a very bold move, and it's a very important move because I mean, when you go to cancer conferences, you'll see a lot of mice that are cured from their cancers, but yet not all of these therapies come. Some will come through and will be very efficient in the human and will be a huge success.
How similar is the genome of a mice compared to a human, percentage-wise?
I would need to check again, but it's something I would say between 96%.
Okay.
It's in the high 90s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, the mice are very much a used model also for many reasons, but one of the reasons is also just their size and their ability to be bred very quickly.
Yeah, because I was going to ask about that. How do you go from giving a mice a treatment and then introducing it to a human? 96%, yes, but still, I'm guessing it's a big difference.
Yeah, so I mean, the most important thing really for safety, especially in the context in which I'm working in, is to test the drug or the therapy. It depends. I worked on biologics or now also again on cell therapy like previously. Is really that you use human cells and human primary cells, so that are truly isolated from healthy organs, for example.
What is a primary cell?
So primary cell is a cell that has been isolated from an organ, from a human being. So it's not as opposed to a cell line. Cell lines are, they can proliferate forever. They have genes that are changed so that you can proliferate them pretty much forever. And although these are very important models for us using cell lines, and this is how we do our high throughput research, if you want to say so, because you can't do that with primary cells. It's, first of all, expensive. It's very hard to access. And then, of course, you can't expand these cells forever because they shouldn't, because they're normal cells from humans. Or alternatively, also what's very important, so that's on the toxicity side, but what's very important also for the efficacy side is to look at cell lines that have been isolated from the relevant tumors that you would want to treat, because they will give you an idea of the efficacy with those tumor cells.
I see. Immunotherapy treatments compared to radiotherapy or chemotherapy, what are the side effects?
It depends on the type of immunotherapy, but there is a few side effects that are very common to all of them, I would say. So because they are engaging the immune system, there is a risk to develop a so-called cytokine release syndrome. And this is a very common side effect where the immune cells are very much activated and they make those transmitters, if you want to say so, to tell other immune cells there is a danger there. That are called cytokines, and these cytokines can cause inflammation in all sorts of different organs. And if it's very, very severe inflammation in the body, it can attack all sorts of organs, but also it can attack the brain. And then that brings me to a second quite common toxicity, which is a neurotoxicity. So the brain can be swelling as a consequence of that.
Okay.
So I would say these are the two first that would come to mind. There are some others. You typically have fever, shivers. And yet, I think it's important also to mention that there is good treatment for these side effects in that context. So for instance, when the immune system gets too activated, you can give steroids to the patient to take it down a bit, but it doesn't mean that it will completely abrogate the effect of the immunotherapy. It will slow down the immune cells again, just to make it slower.
Is inflammation the root to all evil?
That's a big question. I'm sure there are some huge experts on this. I know I have one friend who is always telling me about, you know, the inflammation in his body and how he's trying to keep the inflammation down. I think chronic inflammation is not a good thing and is something that will have a very bad effect on, in many ways on our body. I think also it depends a little bit on the level of inflammation, and I guess it's how far do you want to take this? So if you wanted to have a body without any inflammation, you probably need to almost stop living because you need to be sure to save yourself from a lot of very good things in life.
Exactly. So let's say I eat the chocolate bar compared to meat. What kind of difference in inflammation would I get? Sugar versus fat.
Oh gosh, you asked the wrong question. I don't even want to know, quite honestly. I like food too much.
Yeah, no, because I read that having a high fat diet could often is very helpful when doing cancer therapy and not eating carbohydrates. I don't know if you know anything about this.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of different theories. There's also a theory that you shouldn't eat any red meat and only vegetables and very much, for example, broccoli in particular. Yep. Broccoli is very well known, by the way, for bladder cancer. And that's, in fact, proven that bladder cancer outcomes can be improved. It doesn't mean that one doesn't need therapy, by the way, but it can be a very good support to actually eat a lot of broccoli. And not just broccoli. I think there is a couple of other vegetables that have the same, you know, it's antioxidants that will help very much.
So there's no consensus really on the best diet for avoiding these kind of diseases.
I think there's a lot of debate around this.
Sure.
And I think that's a whole, really a whole area of research altogether. And and I do believe that one can have, one can influence, especially when one is in treatment of cancer, one can certainly support, be supportive with what one eats and how one, the lifestyle one leads. But it doesn't mean that if your whole life you're only going to eat certain vegetables or only meat, that you're going to be very healthy. It's a bit like with everything in life. I think the key is always a balance to everything and not do anything too extreme.
I see. What about the collaboration between the public sector and the private sector? How does it work in this field?
Yeah, so I would say, especially when looking at biotech companies, like the companies I've worked in my whole career, there is quite a bit of collaboration between the public sector and the private sector. Because, well, first of all, a lot of the time biotech companies are spin-outs from institutions. So there is a technology that was developed at an institute. And then in order to develop it further and to make it ready for the clinic to commercialize it after, there is a company that's formed, and that's typically very small startups. And then there is still a very close relationship very often between the startup and the original institution. Also, during development of the drug, so as soon as it goes to, for example, clinical studies, of course, there's a lot of collaboration with the university hospitals, of course, because these are the ones that are typically performing the clinical studies and will take part, a very active part in the clinical studies. I think pharma companies are maybe a little bit less close to the public sector, I would say. And typically, like a biotech, when they get bigger, either they start collaborating also with pharma companies, because then they get also some funding injection for what they're trying to do, and they don't have, you know, the money to make big phase 2-3 trials. And this is how the relationship then is. But I think really between private sector, it is private sector and private sectors. I would say biotechs are really quite close to the public sector, and probably pharma companies a little bit less so.
Which kind of research gets the most funding in this field?
Do you mean in cancer immunotherapy? Yeah. There's always waves of fashion. I wouldn't be able to tell you in Norway specifically. I think more generally speaking, there was a huge wave originally with some, well, based on the checkpoint inhibitors that are very successful for a range of solid tumors that have been, that, you know, the checkpoint inhibitors is what Jim Allison and Tasuku Honsho have received the Nobel Prize in 2018. And they have had a massive impact on a lot of solid tumors. So on the back of that, there was a lot of money poured into a lot of different types of antibodies for different targets trying to do the same thing, so to activate the immune system, not all of which worked out, of course. And then this next wave was really very much around cell therapies, and that was very much driven by the success of CAR T-cell therapies in different B-cell malignancies, as well as multiple myeloma. And now, what's next? You know, there is a next wave, I think, that's very, yeah, very famous right now is ADCs, but that's not really, that's a bit further on. So I think still cell therapy is still very much what's happening a lot currently, and where a lot of money goes.
Yeah. I have to ask, because looking from the outside, how long has chemo and radiotherapy been used?
How long? Yeah. Historically? Ooh, I would need to look this up, quite honestly, but certainly over 100 years. Yeah. In fact, I'm just reading a book, very interesting book, The Emperor of All Maladies. And in there, one can read this up, and I should know this because I read this part already, but it certainly is a good 100 years ago.
Because that's why I'm asking it. It looks from the outside that these are kind of Stone Age therapies, because there's not been a major development. That's from the outside, of course. What do you say?
Well, the...
Because you really hurt a lot more than tumor.
You do. Yeah. And the trouble is, I think that will shift very much maybe in the next 10 to 20 years, when all of these more targeted therapies are more established and more patients have been treated with them and there is more knowledge on it. And as I said earlier, I think the reason why that still is because for a long time there wasn't huge movement in cancer therapy. And it's only really been, I would say, the last maybe 30 years or so that really there was step by step, there was more and more really exciting developments on different fronts, not just immunotherapy, of course. But different targeted approaches or more specifically tailored approaches to specific types of groups of cancers. And the trouble is it takes a long time to come through, because we're treating these patients that have no options. Then only these patients, so once we get approval and, you know, the government say, okay, the healthcare system will pay for this kind of therapy, they will approve this only as a last resort for this patient. Yeah. Then you need to make another clinical trial to say, okay, we want now to try to do this. Let's say that's the fifth line of treatment. Yeah. We want now to try this in fourth line. Yeah. And so you kind of slowly have to work your way up to make this the first line therapy. Yeah. That takes time and money.
Even though results can be very promising, it takes a long time.
It does. Yeah. It's like research and therapy development is not anything fast-paced, which is why, by the way, was so impressive about the fast pace of the COVID vaccines coming through. Very exciting for the whole field, I would say, that this was enabled also by the governments to be able to fast-track. And I think there was a lot of learnings also for other types of therapies, how one can maybe combine still a very ethical approach with, you know, not endangering patients and yet at the same time come to the patient quicker and come to an approval quicker.
Will there be a cancer vaccine for different types?
So there is already studies ongoing, and some are more and some are less successful. I think that it might be a possibility that for, as we call them, more immunogenic cancers, it could be successful. So for instance, what is immunogenic cancers? Cancers that have a lot of different mutations. So when you have huge variety mutation in a type of cancer, then the immune system, you're more likely to be able to trigger the immune system to do something about it, because it's more likely to be, so to speak, immunogenic. There is cancers that are not at all immunogenic. And for instance, one of them is also pancreatic cancer. And it means that these cancers have a very low number of mutations for it to be cancer in comparison to others. And there, I think it would be very hard to develop a successful cancer vaccine.
Yeah. What kind of role will AI play?
A huge role. I mean, currently, as soon as you write AI in your company pitch, you can be sure to have a few millions more for your research.
Yeah.
Whether all of this is going to be, you know, very successful, I don't know. But certainly, I'm sure that AI will play a big role. And in different ways, by the way. So first of all, for discovery, but also for, on the very other end of the spectrum, looking at really understanding patient populations and especially identifying these more different rare diseases, also rare cancers also, and having a fast way of understanding patterns of mutations and what type of medicine they might actually respond to better.
So if you're going to give some advice to early researchers interested in pursuing a career like yours, what would it be?
Passion. Have passion for it. If you don't have passion for it, it's not the right career, I think. It's really, you need to get up every day and really want to do this and be excited about it. It's especially in the biotech environment, it's a very high pressure environment. You always run against timelines and you always have to be fast. If you are 3 months slower, this is millions of loss for your investors. They will not be very happy. So you really have to be on it. And also, it's not just, you know, I gave the example with the investors, but it's not just that. It's also, there's a lot of people working on different therapies. If you're too slow, someone else is going to be faster and is going to be the first one that is going to bring that type of therapy to the market.
Is there a problem that this is capital driven?
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it a problem. I guess, of course, to a certain extent, it is because, you know, we are very dependent on the money that is being put into our therapies, and clinical trials are hugely expensive. I mean, you really need, especially for cell therapy development, you need a lot of money. So it is a problem, but at the same time, how else would it work? You know, yeah. I mean, how, that's just the way that the world works. And so we need the money to be able to perform all these clinical trials, unfortunately.
And such a, should I say, pressure-driven environment, how do you cope?
Well, as I said, I think it's really due to the excitement about what I do. And the coping mechanism is also because you work very much as a team. And so it's so much fun to work together as a team to achieve this and to have this big goal. And, you know, for instance, for us this year, it's really getting to a so-called IND submission at the end of this year. So what that means is we are planning to submit our first product for a clinical trial.
Okay.
And this is very, very exciting. So all of us are in it together. It's a huge team effort. It's just beautiful to work in a team and to have this team spirit.
What are the ethical considerations in a new field like this?
Yeah, so the ethical considerations are, and this is why we're treating patients that have no further option, is that you treat only patients that have no other option, indeed, because there's always a risk. As much as you de-risk preclinically and you look at, you know, potential toxicities on normal primary cells from humans or any potential inflammation you could cause with your therapy, the last bit of risk you can only de-risk when you treat your first patients. So the other part of ethics there is that, of course, there's a lot of guidelines around how you start your dosing. So you don't start with a high dose, of course. You start with a dose that's very, very small. And then you need to have a balance in terms of ethics, how low the dose is and how many patients you treat, because you also don't want to have a lot of very low doses where, you know, they're not going to have a positive effect for the patient. And yet the patient needs to go through all of this.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of guidelines around it. And I think it has been developed very, very thoroughly by all the different government, by all the institutions like the FDA in the US and the MHRA and the EMA in Europe. And so it's been I think that there's really a very good ethics framework for all patients, luckily.
Mm. There's something in medicine called the number needed to treat.
Mm.
And that is obviously that you need a certain number of patients to before someone is helped by the medicine. Is that correct?
What do you mean someone? Oh, you mean that the medicine is approved and can be used as such? Or what do you mean?
No, I'm thinking
that?
If you have a new medicine on the market and you need, let's say you need 10 patients before one is helped, for example, with statins for heart disease.
Yes.
How difficult is it, because I'm guessing all humans are different, how difficult is it to find a medicine or a treatment that actually works on a broad scale?
Mm. So as I said earlier, the challenge with cancer is that diversity, right? But if you have a certain group of cancer patients that you know your product works well for, you know, there is very good successes in the very recent developments like the checkpoint inhibitors I mentioned earlier, or the CAR T-cell therapies I mentioned earlier also, where you really have successes in probably for some therapies, some, you know, again, subgroups of patients of like 80-90%. The question is very often, how long are they in remission?
Yeah.
So how long a lot of them, you will be able to have an effect and to give them some quality of life back after their treatment. But the question is for how long, and it depends very much on the context. So for instance, for example, B-cell malignancies with the CAR T-cells, you have really very long-lasting remissions. One of the most famous ones is the kind of, as they call it, poster child ALL, where like Emily Whitehead was treated in 2012, and she is now over 10 years in remission after having really had no options anymore and receiving, at the time that was still in the clinical trial, this treatment. So there is long remissions, but then, for example, my multiple myeloma CAR T-cell therapy, again, you have very good rates in initially clearing the disease and giving the patients more quality of life back after the treatment, even though the treatment is harsh for sure. So first it's a harsh treatment, but then they will regain some quality of life for a longer term, you know, than they would have lived without this treatment. But at the same time, they often relapse quite a bit faster and more likely. So that's a challenge in cancer in particular, that even though you might have very high initial successes, even like 80-90% for certain types of medicines or therapies in combination with certain types of cancers, the question is always the longevity of that remission.
Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to share?
I don't know, just my excitement for cancer immunotherapy and the fact that, you know, in the meantime, I think it's pretty much half of the it covers pretty much half of the biggest cancer therapy conference in the world, because there's such a huge field. We have so much more to learn about the immune system per se, really basic research about cancer, and then combining this and becoming more and more sophisticated in how we actually apply these different approaches. This is very exciting. And also, I mean, we didn't get to talk about this now, but, you know, combinations is really key to everything. Combining different approaches and collaborating and making sure that the patient receives therapies from different angles to hopefully really knock the cancer cells out entirely.
Yeah. Last question. What is the meaning of life?
To enjoy the journey.
Thanks for an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Tusen takk for at du hørte på Bendixen Airways. Dersom du har tips, kommentarer eller vil gi en vurdering av episoden, så gjør gjerne det. Det setter jeg stor pris på.